This is Audible.
Sold by Patricia McCormick. Narrated by Justina. Copyright 2006 by Patricia McCormick. This unabridged audiobook is published by arrangement with Hyperion Children and was produced in the year 2012 by Tantor Media Incorporated, which holds the copyright thereto. A tin roof. "One more rainy season and our roof will be gone," says Hama. My mother is standing on a log ladder, inspecting the thatch, and I am on the ground, handing the laundry up to her so it can bake dry in the afternoon sun. There are no clouds in sight, no hint of rain, no chance of it for weeks. There is no use in telling Amma this, though. She is looking down the mountain at the rice terraces that descend, step by step, to the village below, at the neighbor's tin roofs winking cruelly back at her. A tin roof means that the family has a father who doesn't gamble away the landlord's money playing cards in the tea shop. A tin roof means the family has a son working at the brick kiln in the city. A tin roof means that when the rains come, the fire stays lit and the baby stays healthy. "Let me go to the city," I say. "I can work for a rich family like Gita does and send my wages home to you." Amma strokes my cheek, the skin of her work-worn hand as rough as the tongue of a newborn goat. "Lakshmi, my child," she says, "you must stay in school, no matter what your stepfather says." Lately, I want to tell her, my stepfather looks at me the same way he looks at the cucumbers I'm growing in front of our hut. He flicks the ash from his cigarette and squints.
"You'd better get a good price for them," he says.
When he looks, he sees cigarettes and rice beer, a new vest for himself. I see a tin roof. Before Gita left, we drew squares in the dusty path between our huts and played the hopping on one leg game. We brushed each other's hair 100 strokes and dreamed of names for our sons and daughters. We pinched our noses shut whenever the headman's wife passed by, recalling the time she broke wind strutting past us at the village spring. We rubbed the rough-edged notch in the school bench for good luck before a recitation. We threw mud at each other during the long afternoon stooped over in the paddies and wept with laughter when one of Gita's mud pies hit her haughty older sister in the back of the head. And in the fall, when the goat herds came down from the Himalayan meadows, we hid in the elephant grass to catch sight of Krishna, the boy with sleepy cat eyes, the one I am promised to in marriage. Now that Gita is gone to work as a maid for a wealthy woman in the city, her family has a tiny glass sun that hangs from a wire in the middle of their ceiling, a new set of pots for Gita's mother, a pair of spectacles for her father, a brocaded wedding dress for her older sister, and school fees for her little brother. Inside Gita's family's hut, it is daytime at night. But for me, it feels like nighttime, even in the brightest sun, without my friend. The New Student. Each morning as I go about my chores, straining the rice water, grinding the spices, sweeping the yard, my little black and white speckled goat Tali follows at my heels. "That silly goat," Amma says. "She thinks you are her mother." Tali nudges her head into the palm of my hand and bleats in agreement, and so I teach her what I know. I wipe the hard mud floor with a rag soaked in dung water and explain, "This will keep our hut cool and free from evil spirits." I show her how I lash a water jug to the basket on my back, not spilling a drop on the steep climb up from the village spring. And when I brush my teeth with a twig from the neem tree, Tali copies me, nibbling her twig as solemn as a monk. When it's time for me to go to school, I make her a bed of straw in a sunny corner of the porch. I kiss her between the ears and tell her I'll be home in time for the midday meal. She presses her moist pink nose into the pocket of my skirt, searching for a bit of stowaway grain, then settles down, a jumble of elbows and knees, burrowing into the straw to nap. "What a funny animal," Amma says. "She thinks she is a possum." Amma must be right, because one day last week when I was sitting in the schoolroom, I heard the tinkling of her bell and looked up and saw my little speckled goat wandering around the schoolyard, bleating in despair. When finally she spotted me through the window, she baaed with wounded pride, indignant at being left behind. She marched across the yard, propped her hooves up on the windowsill, and looked in with keen and curious eyes as the teacher finished the lesson. When school was over and we climbed the hill toward home, Tali trotted ahead, her stubby tail held high. "Next week," I promised her, "we will work on our spelling." Something beautiful. In the morning, Amma bends down to stir the kitchen fire and to plait my hair before I go to school. All day she trudges up and down the mountain, a heavy basket braced on her back and held fast by a rope around her brow. She is bent under the weight of her burden. And at night, as she serves my stepfather his dinner, she kneels at his feet. Even when she is standing upright to scan the sky for rain clouds, my Amma's back is stooped. The people who live on our mountain, a cluster of red mud huts clinging to the slope, worship the goddess who lives there, on the swallow-tailed peak. They pray to the goddess whose brow is fierce and noble, whose breast is broad and bountiful, whose snowy skirts spread wide above us. She is beautiful, mighty, and magnificent. But my Amma, with her crow-black hair braided with bits of red rag and beads, her cinnamon skin, and her ears hung with a joyful noise of tinkling gold, is to me more lovely. And her slender back, which bears our troubles and all our hopes, is more beautiful still. The difference between a son and a daughter. My stepfather's arm is a withered and useless thing. Broken as a child when there was no money for a doctor, his poor mangled limb pains him during the rainy months and gives him great shame. Most of the men his age leave home for months at a time, taking jobs at factories or in work crews far away. But no one, he says, will hire a one-armed man. And so he oils his hair, puts on his vest and a wristwatch that stopped telling time long ago, and goes up the hill each day to play cards, talk politics, and drink tea with the old men. Amma says we are lucky to have a man at all. She says I am to honor and praise him, respect and thank him for taking us in after my father died. And so I act the part of the dutiful daughter. I bring him his tea in the morning and rub his feet at night. I pretend I do not hear him joining in the laughter when the men at the tea shop joke about the difference between fathering a son and marrying off a daughter. A son will always be a son, they say, but a girl is like a goat. Good as long as she gives you milk and butter, but not worth crying over when it's time to make a stew. Beyond the Himalayas. At dawn, our hut, perched high on the mountainside, is already torched with sunlight, while the village below remains cloaked in the mountain's long purple shadow until mid-morning. By midday, the tawny fields will be dotted with the cheerful dresses of the women, red as the poinsettias that lace the windy footpaths. Napping babies will sway in wicker baskets, and lizards will sun themselves outside their holes. In the evening, the brilliant yellow pumpkin blossoms will close, drunk on sunshine, while the milky white jasmine will open their slender throats and sip the chill Himalayan air. At night, low hearths will send up wispy curls of smoke, fragrant with a dozen dinners, and darkness will clothe the land. Except on nights when the moon is full, on those nights, the hillside and the valley below are bathed in a magical white light, the glow of the perpetual snows that blanket the mountain tops. On those nights, I lie restless in the sleeping loft, wondering what the world is like beyond my mountain home. Calendar. At school, there is a calendar, where my young, moon-faced teacher marks off the days with a red crayon. On the mountain, we mark time by women's work and women's woes. In the cold months, the women climb high up the mountain spine to scavenge for firewood. They take food from their bowls, feed it to their children, and silence their own churning stomachs. This is the season when the women bury the children who die of fever. In the dry months, the women collect basketfuls of dung and put them into cakes to harden in the sun, making precious fuel for the dinner fire. They tie rags around their children's eyes to shield them from the dust blowing up from the empty riverbed. This is the season when they bury the children who die from the coughing disease. In the rainy months, they patch the crumbling mud walls of their huts and keep the fire going so that yesterday's gruel can be stretched to make tomorrow's dinner. They watch the river turn into a thundering beast. They pick leeches from their children's feet and give them tea to ward off the loose bowel disease. This is the season when they bury the children who cannot be carried to the doctor on the other side of that river. In the cool months, they prepare special food for the festivals. They make rice beer for the men and listen to them argue politics. They teach the children who have survived the seasons to make back-to-school ink from the blue-black juice of the mocking nut tree. This is also the season when the women drink the blue-black juice of the mocking nut tree to do away with the babies in their wombs, the ones who'd be born only to be buried next season. Another calendar. According to the number of notches in Alma's wedding trunk, she is 31 and I am 13. If my baby brother lives through the festival season, Alma will carve a notch for him. Four other babies were born between me and my brother. There are no notches for them. Confession. Each of my cucumbers has a name. There is the tiny one, Muti, which means size of a handful. Muti gets the first drink of the day. Nearby is Yeti, the biggest one, named for the hairy snow monster. Yeti grows so fat, little Muti cowers under a nearby leaf in fear and awe. There is Ananta, the one shaped like a snake, and Bajai, the gnarled grandmother of the group. Vishnu, as sleek as rain, and Nasma, the ugly one, named for the headman's wife. There is one named for my hen and three for her chicks, one for Gita and one for Ganesh, the elephant god, remover of obstacles. I treat them all as my children. But sometimes, if my water jug runs low, I scrimp a bit on Nasma. First Blood. I awoke today, before even the hen had begun to stir, aware of a change in myself. For days I have sensed a ripening in my body, a tender, achy feeling, unlike anything I felt before. And even before I go to the privy to check, I know that I have gotten my first blood. Alma is delighted by my news and sets about making the arrangements for my confinement. "You must stay out of sight for 7 days," she says. "Even the sun cannot see you until you've been purified." Before the day can begin, Alma hurries me off to the goat shed, where I will spend the week shut away from the world. "Don't come out for any reason," she says. "If you must use the privy, cover your face and head with your shawl." "At night," she says, "when your stepfather has gone out and the baby has gone to sleep, I will return. And then I will tell you everything you need to know." Everything I need to know. "Before today," Alma says, "you could run as free as a leaf in the wind. Now," she says, "you must carry yourself with modesty, bow your head in the presence of men, and cover yourself with your shawl. Never look a man in the eye. Never allow yourself to be alone with a man who is not family. And never look at growing pumpkins or cucumbers when you are bleeding. Otherwise they will rot. Once you are married," she says, "you must eat your meal only after your husband has had his fill. Then you may have what remains. If he burps at the end of the meal, it is a sign that you have pleased him. If he turns to you in the night, you must give yourself to him in the hopes that he will bear him a son. If you have a son, feed him at your breast until he is 4.
If you have a daughter, feed her at your breast for just a season, so that your blood will start again, and you can try once more to bear a son. If your husband asks you to wash his feet, you must do as he says, then put a bit of the water in your mouth. I ask Amma why. Why, I say, must women suffer so? This has always been our fate, she says. Simply to endure, she says, is to triumph. Waiting and watching. For 7 days and 7 nights, I lie in the darkness of the goat shed, dreaming of my future. I bury my nose in Tali's fur and breathe in the smell of her, sweet green shoots of grass, afternoon sun, and mountain dart, and imagine my life with Krishna. Amma says that I must wait until next year when she visits the astrologer to fix a date for our wedding. But I would go live with him in the mountains tomorrow if I could. We could eat river weed and drink snow melt and sleep under the silver white light of the mountain. And someday we could hang a cloth from a tree branch and put our baby in it, and she would sleep with the bleating of the goats as her only lullaby. Until then, I will content myself with watching him. I was watching when he won a foot race against the fastest boy in the village, and I was there the day he put a lizard in the teacher's teacup. I was at the village fountain when the other boys teased him for hauling water for his mother, and I was peeking out from around the corner of Bajai Sita's store the time he smoked his first cigarette, and he coughed until he cried. Krishna is shy when he passes me in the village, his sleepy cat eyes fixed on the ground in front of his feet. But I think, perhaps, that he has been watching me, too. Announcing the dry season. The wind that blows up from the plains is called the Lu. It churns all day, hot and restless, throwing handfuls of dirt into the air and making the water in my mouth turn to mud. It cries all night too, blowing its feverish breath through the cracks in our walls, speaking its name again and again. Lu, it wails, announcing itself all over the land. Lu! 50 days without rain. The leaves of my cucumbers are edged in brown, and Amma and I must each make 20 trips down the mountain to the village spring, waiting our turn to bring water up to the rice paddy. My stepfather dozes in the shade, wearing nothing but a loincloth, too hot even to climb the hill to his card game. The baby wears nothing at all. Even the lizards lie gasping in the heat. Making do. Today, the village headmen announced that they will ration water. Tonight, Amma and I scrub the cooking vessels clean with a mixture of earth and ash. 60 days without rain. The rice plants are brown and parched, coated in dust. The wind rips the weakest of them out by the roots and tosses them off the mountainside. Tali creeps over to the creek bed and rests her chin on the bank, her tongue searching for water that isn't there. The baby's eyes are caked with dirt. He cries without fury. He cries without tears. Maybe tomorrow. Today, like yesterday and the day before, and the day before that, the sky is deadly blue. Today, like each day before, the water in the rice paddy drops a little farther, and the plants hang their heads a little lower. I watch as Amma makes an offering of marigold petals, red kumkum powder, and a few precious bits of rice to her goddess, praying for rain. But the only water that falls comes from Amma's eyes. I go back to mopping the baby's face with a damp rag. As Amma goes past, I touch the hem of her skirt. Maybe tomorrow, Amma, I say. My stepfather rises from his cot.
If the rains don't come soon, he says to my mother, you will have to sell your earrings.
Yesterday, or the day before, or the day before that, Amma would have said, never. She would have said, those are for Lakshmi, they are her dowry. But today she hangs her head like the paddy plants and says, maybe tomorrow.
What is missing? The next morning, I rise before the sun has climbed over the mountain and walk down to the village spring, my feet making tiny dust storms with each step. When I get home, I notice that my stepfather's cot is empty. He's behind the hut, I expect, in the privy. Before he can return to start calling out orders, I sneak over to my garden plot with the first of the day's water for my thirsty cucumbers. I lift the leaf where Muti likes to hide. But all I see is a stem, looking surprised, lonely. Ananta the snake and even Big Fat Yeti are also missing, as are all the others. I understand slowly, then all at once, that my stepfather has taken my cucumbers to Bajai Sita, the old trader woman, and sold them. I understand, too, why his cot is empty. Most likely he has spent the night gambling and losing at the tea shop. I know this is so when Amma comes out of the hut and does not meet my eye. She takes the urn from my hands, pours the water over the few rice plants that remain. We strap the jugs to our backs, head down toward the spring, and do not speak of what is missing. When the rain came, I smelled the rain before it fell. I felt the air grow heavy like roti dough, and saw the leaves of the eucalyptus tree turn their silvery undersides up to greet it. The first few droplets vanished in the dust. Then bigger drops fell, fat and ripe, exploding the earth. Amma came out of the house, pulling her shawl over her head. Then, slowly, she lifted the folds of fabric away from her brow and, like the leaves of the eucalyptus tree, raised her waiting face toward heaven. I ran across the yard, released Tali from her wooden peg, and led her to the creek bed, her tongue unwilling to trust. Then, little by little, a trickle of muddy water came hopping down the gully. Tali lapped and snuffled and snorted and sneezed and drank herself silly, her bony sides billowing with water. I shut my eyes tight, letting the tears that had been gathering there finally spill down my cheeks, where they could hide inside the rain. Strange music. I awake the next day to a forgotten sound. Even before the rest of us have stirred, Amma has spread pots and pitchers around the floor of the hut to catch the water seeping in through the gaps in our roof. I climb down from the sleeping loft, stir the fire, and brew a new pot of tea from yesterday's leaves, not daring to meet Amma's eyes, each drip a reminder of the tin roof we don't have. Then the baby awakes, and with each drip and plink and plop and ping, he laughs and claps his hands. Each drip new. Each plink and plop and ping, fresh and strange and musical to his tiny ears. Amma wipes her hands on her apron, looks up at our old roof with new eyes, and lifts the baby from his basket. She twirls him in the air, her skirts flying around her ankles, the way the clouds swirl around the mountain cup, her laughter fresh and strange and musical to my ears. Maybe. That night, after my stepfather leaves for the tea shop and the baby falls asleep, Amma reaches behind a big urn for a smaller one. She feels around behind that urn for an even smaller one, reaches inside, and pulls out a handful of maize. "I set this aside in the dry months," she says. "For a night?" She gestures to the falling rain outside. "Like tonight." She pours the kernels into the skillet, sits back on her heels, and we watch as they burst into flower. I offer to share the little bowl of popcorn with her, but Amma has another surprise in store. She unwinds the fabric at her waist and pulls out one of my stepfather's precious cigarettes, and I see in that moment the mischievous girl she was at my age. We sit together, each savoring our secret treats and dreaming of the days after the monsoon. "The first thing we'll do," I say, "is patch the roof." "No, child," she says, solemnly blowing smoke in the air. "First we'll offer thanks to the goddess. Then we'll mend the roof." She inhales. Perhaps this year we can beg some new thatch from the landlord, she says. Maybe this year you can tie it down while I pat it fast with mud. Somehow, as she smokes her stolen cigarette and I eat my popcorn, she makes the job of thatching the roof sound like a joy. With the money from this year's crop, she says, we may have enough to make you a new dress. Perhaps from that red and gold fabric you've been eyeing at Bajaj Sita's store. I lower my eyes, embarrassed and glad all at once. Maybe, I say, there will be enough to go to Bajaj Sita and buy sugar for sweet cakes. Maybe, she says, we can buy extra seed this year and plant the empty field behind the hut. Maybe, I say, we can borrow Gita's uncle's water buffalo. I can drive the plough and you can spread the seed. We sit there in the flickering light of a shallow saucer of oil, already rich with harvest money. As we linger over the last of our luxuries, Arma inhales a cigarette down to a stub. I wipe a stubborn last kernel from the bowl with my fingertip. We don't say what we both know. But the first thing we must do is pay the landlord. And Gita's uncle, who sold us last season's seed. And the headman's wife, who would not trade cooking oil for work. And my teacher, who gave me her own pencil when she saw I had none. And the owner of the tea shop, who, my stepfather says, cheats at cards. Instead, we linger over a luxury that costs nothing, imagining what may be. What the monsoon does. It doesn't rain constantly during the monsoon. There is usually a shower in the morning that leaves behind stripes of color in the sky. And another in the afternoon that leaves the rice plants plump and drowsy. But all night there is a long, soaking rain that leaves the footpaths sloppy and hearts refreshed. Too much of a good thing. 8 days and nights and nothing but rain. Curtains of rain that blind me, even on the short, familiar path to the privy. Trying to remember. The rain is so fierce, so relentless, so merciless, it finds every crack in our roof. Amma and I pack the walls with scraps of cloth, but each day they melt a little more. When there is a rare moment of sun, the women gather on the slope, shake their heads and say, "This is the worst monsoon in years." After several more days when there is no sun at all, the village headmen gather in the tea shop and ask the holy man to say a special prayer to make it stop. I wait at home as the damp firewood sizzles and smokes, trying to keep the baby from catching a chill. He wrestles with the blanket, bored and cranky from days on end inside. While I try to remember the days when the heat was so fierce, so relentless, so merciless, that we prayed for this rain. What disaster sounds like. When the night rain soaks the ground past the soaking point, when the earthen walls around the paddy melt away, when the rice plants are sucked out of the earth one by one and washed down the slope, there should be a sound, a noise announcing that something is terribly wrong. Instead, there is a ghostly hush that tells us we have lost everything. A bitter harvest. I tell Amma not to weep, that surely there are a few stalks of rice left in our field. I run outside and splash through what remains of our paddy. With frantic hands I claw at the mud. Finally, when I stand, my hands aching with emptiness, I see Gita's family in the plot below ours. Gita's father did not spend his afternoons in the tea shop. He spent his days building paddy walls that could stand up to the monsoon. Now he faces the swallow-tailed peak, his hands in a prayer of gratitude. His rice plants bow to the sun, his little boy splashes in the mud. My stomach churns with something bitter. I do not know if it is hunger or envy. The price of a loan. My stepfather has been gone a week and a day. He said he was going to visit his brother 2 villages away to ask for a loan. But I wonder, when I see the owner of the tea shop looking at Amma with squinty coin eyes, if my stepfather has run away. Amma has been gone since daybreak. She said she was going to the village to sell our hen and her chicks. But I wonder, when I picture Bajai Sita and her little lizard face, if Amma will get more than a pocketful of rice. Amma and I can do without food, but the baby is beginning to grow listless. Now, as he whimpers in his basket, I wish for the noisy cries that I used to wish away. I watch for Amma on the path below and wonder what will be lost next. Later, when I see her climbing the hill to our hut, I know. It is the joyful noise of her earrings and the proud set of her head. How long this will last. Although the path to our hut has washed away, a parade of people comes to the door. First is the landlord. He asks for my stepfather, but Amma says it is she who will pay the rent this time. She unwinds her waistcloth, removes a handful of rupee notes from her money pouch, and sends him on his way. Then comes Geeta's uncle. He looks at our paddy, our hut, then at the baby, and says he will take half of what we owe. The headman's wife is next. She says full payment is due, as well as 50 rupees extra for interest. I do not go to school, so I do not have to face my pretty, moon-faced teacher empty-handed. We eat rice and lentils with the money Amma got for her earrings. The baby eats curds and fruit and grows fat and feisty again. One night, Amma makes sweet cakes with Bajai Sita's sugar. My stomach complains a bit, unaccustomed to such richness, but I don't let on to Amma, who watches me, but does not eat. We are, in the evenings as we sit by lamplight, happy. I wonder, though, how long it will be before the owner of the tea shop knocks on our door. Or how many nights until my stepfather comes home with another debt to repay. Or, if he never returns, how long until the money in Amma's waistcloth runs out? Stranger. A strange man is climbing toward our hut. He is wearing a city coat and a triangle hat, high on one side and low on the other, like the one the landlord wears on rent day. The women at the spring have talked of government men who hand out money to people who sign papers. I will read the words for Amma and show her where to sign. Then we won't have to worry about anything. Suddenly, though, I am afraid. I have never spoken to a city man, so I run inside and peek at him through the window. Amma is bent over in the field. She straightens up, sees the man, and walks toward him. Then she kneels and touches her brow to his feet. I see then that this stranger is my stepfather, in a big shoulders city coat and a hat that sits on his head like a lopsided mountain peak. Amma stands and goes to the fire to bring him some lentils. She puts a finger to her lip as she goes past me. Even a man who gambles away what little we have on a fancy hat and a new coat, she says, is better than no man at all. Festival of Lights. On the first day of the festival, we honor the crows. We put out offerings of rice, because crows are the messengers for the Lord of Death. On the second day, we honor the dogs. We dot their foreheads with red powder and place marigold garlands around their necks, because dogs are the guides to the land of the dead. And on the third day, we clean our homes top to bottom. We put out dozens of tiny oil lamps at dusk to welcome the goddess Lakshmi, my namesake, who will circle the earth and bestow wealth and blessings on the humble and the pure. Our family has no grain to spare for the crow, and nothing for the stray dog, save a kick from my stepfather's sandal. Still, Amma says we must prepare for Lakshmi's arrival. Amma sweeps every corner of our hut and sets the blankets out to air. Then she twists tiny bits of rag into wicks and places them in shallow clay saucers, each with a drop of oil. When my chores are done, I sit out in the sun in front of our hut and string a necklace of marigolds. We have no dog, so I make the garland for Tali. But when I go to place the wreath over her head, she shrinks away. I scratch the place between her ears just the way she likes. Then, as her head droops with contentment, I slip the garland around her neck. She sniffs and sneezes and shakes her head from side to side. Then she bends low, her ear to the ground, and tries to wriggle out of it. Finally, she gets to her feet, and with one grand, impatient toss of her head, she throws the garland in the dirt and eats it. Amma comes by and smiles. "That goat," she says. "Perhaps she is not so silly after all." An auspicious night. 1,000 stars have fallen to earth. That at least is how it looks to me as I sit outside our hut and look down the mountainside at all the houses below, each windowsill and doorway adorned with tiny lanterns, lighting the way for the goddess Lakshmi. "This is an auspicious night," says Amma. Her brisk and steady hand flies through my hair as she twines the strands into braids. "The goddess Lakshmi will see our lights and bring us good fortune." My stepfather comes out of the hut, wearing his kingly hat and his big shoulders coat. He pats his chest, and I see Amma's money pouch around his neck. "This," he says, "is an auspicious night. This is the night when the goddess favors gamblers." And because it is my favorite night of the year, the festival of my namesake, I let myself believe him. At the festival, Amma and I walk down to the village, my little brother riding on her back. As we draw near the bonfire, Amma presses a coin into my palm. "Run off and buy yourself a sweet cake," she says, "like the other children." I tell her I'm not a child anymore. I tell her not to waste her money. But she insists. "Tonight," she says, "you are a child." Possibility. As I stand before the bonfire, licking the last of the sweet cake crumbs from my fingers, a city woman comes and stands next to me. She is wearing a dress of yellow cloud fabric, 100 silver bangles on her wrists and ankles. She smells of amber and night flowers. "Where I live," she says, "the girls have sweet cakes every day." This delicate stranger, it seems, is speaking to me. I steal a sideways look at her. She smiles, drawing her shawl to her lips with the dignity of a queen. I too draw my shawl to my face, see that I have the calloused hands of a farm girl, and stuff them in the pockets of my homespun skirt. "City girls have pretty dresses," she says from behind her yellow cloud. "And fancy baubles. They eat oranges, dates and mangoes every day. It is the easy life."
"You," I say, my voice as tiny as a bug's. "You're a maid?"
The city woman laughs, still hiding her mouth with the hem of her shawl, but she does not answer.
"Would you like to come to the city with me?" she says. "I will be your auntie."
I nod yes, no, and run back to Amma, afraid to tell her about this new auntie who smells of amber and jasmine and possibility. Windfall. We are awakened in the middle of the night by a thunderous roaring outside our hut. Amma and I come down to see my stepfather, seated on a machine with two wheels and a pair of metal antlers.
"It is a motorcycle," he says. "I won it from a city boy home for the festival."
The metal beast coughs, and great blasts of smoke come from its tail.
"I told you this was an auspicious night," my stepfather says.
I do not see how this thing is of any use to us, but Amma hugs me and whispers in my ear that we will trade the beast at Bajai Sita's. In an instant, I see it all. We will buy back Amma's earrings. We will have enough money for a drum of cooking oil, a barrel of flour, a new dress for me and one for Amma, a jacket for the baby, a tin roof. Perhaps, I think grudgingly, even enough for a new vest for my stepfather. the next day. In the morning, my stepfather is up early, tending lovingly to his beast. He rubs it down with a rag and talks to it like a baby.
"We are going to the tea shop," he tells it, "so that everyone can envy my good fortune."
The beast, however, balks at his suggestion. It belches and breaks wind, but it will not roar the way it did last night. My stepfather kicks the thing, curses at it, then finally it snarls in reply. My stepfather rides away, slipping and sliding in the mud. Nightfall. It is nearly dark when my stepfather comes back from the tea shop. The beast is nowhere to be seen, and my stepfather is on foot, without his city coat or even his hat. Ama runs to the door, sees, then turns her face to the corner so as not to shame him when he comes in, and climbs the ladder to the sleeping loft. A tiny earthquake. Ama has to be coaxed from bed the next morning with a cup of hot tea. She says she is not ill, but she has the look of a great sickness about her. I put the baby in a basket on my back and go about my chores, all the while keeping my eyes on Ama. Her steps are slow and heavy, and she stops often in her work to shake her head and sigh. At noon, I warm the remains of yesterday's soup, feed it to the baby, then tighten my waistcloth so my own hungry stomach will think it is full. Then I go in search of Ama, so that she can wipe the bowl clean with the last heel of bread. When she doesn't answer my calls, I go outside and find her hiding behind Charlie's shed, weeping. "What is it, Ama?" I say. Ama wipes her cheek with the hem of her shawl.
"Your stepfather has said you must go to the city and earn your keep as a maid."
This news is like a tiny earthquake, shaking the very ground beneath my feet. And yet for Ama, I stand firm. "This is good news, Ama," I say, my voice full of a boldness I did not know I had. "There will be one less mouth to feed here, and I will send my wages home." Ama nods weakly. "If I go, you will have money enough for rice and curds, milk and sugar, enough for a coat for the baby and a sweater for you." She smiles wanly and strokes my cheek with her work-worn hand.
"Enough," I say. "For a tin roof."
City rules. "In the city," says Ama, "the people clean the floors with one rag and the dishes with another. Take care not to mix them up or you will risk a beating. Get up early in the morning before anyone else in the house and be the last one to bed at night. Never sit down in the presence of your mistress or her husband or even in front of the children. And never eat your meal until they have gone to bed. This will prove what a hard worker you are. Hide your wages inside your blouse. That way," she says, "you will fool anyone who thinks you keep your money in your waistcloth. Do not eat any food that comes in a paper wrapper. You do not know who has cooked it. Put a pinch of cardamom in the rice," she says. "This will make it more filling. Stay two steps behind your mistress if you are helping her with the marketing, and keep your head bowed when you are in public, so that the city men cannot see your face. Say your prayers every day and wash your skirt and blouse once a month. You will make us proud," Ama says, "as the first member of our family to leave the mountain, and perhaps at festival time next year your mistress will let you come back to visit. Then you can tell us all about the world beyond this one." A trade. The next morning, my stepfather brings me to Bajai Sita's store. He is carrying Ama's empty firewood basket, and yet he is wearing his vest, his watch, and his best trousers.
"Lakshmi wants to go to work in the city," he tells her.
I feel myself grow taller with his words. Bajai Sita regards me through little lizard eyes.
"Is she a hard worker?" she asks. "She needs a thrashing on occasion," my stepfather says, "but she is not as lazy as some."
My cheeks flame with indignation, but I say nothing. "Are you willing to do whatever is asked of you?" she says. I nod.
I will use a separate rag to wash the dishes, I want to tell her, and I will wait to take my meal until night. Yes, I say, I will do as I am told. She goes behind a curtain and returns with the stranger in the yellow dress. The woman looks me over head to toe, then addresses my stepfather.
How much do you want for her?
She asks, her veil to her lips. My stepfather squints. He takes in the costly fabric of the woman's dress, the baubles on her ears, the silver bangles on her wrist.
1,000 rupees, he says.
There are not that many rupees in the world. I cringe at his backwardness and pray this refined and lovely city woman does not laugh him out of the store. Instead, she motions for him to step inside the back room with her.
She has no hips, I hear her say. And she's plain as porridge. I'll give you 500.
I do not understand. I can carry a load of firewood so heavy it would put a man to shame, and my legs are sturdy enough to climb the mountain 1,000 times in one day. What does it matter that I have no hips yet? My stepfather says he knows the going rate for a young girl like me.
No less than 800.
I will give you half now and the rest when she has proved her worth, she says. My stepfather grunts, and he and the woman return. But Jaisita unfurls a roll of rupee notes from her waistcloth. My stepfather counts the money, then counts it again. Your family will get nothing, not 1 rupee, if you do not obey your new auntie, says Bajai Sita. Do you understand?
I don't understand at all. A great deal of money has just been paid for work I have not yet done. But I nod.
My stepfather counts the money one more time. Tell Amma I will make her proud, I say. Tell her I'll be back for the next festival season. But he has his eyes fixed on the wares on Bajai Sita's shelves. He's taking things and putting them in Amma's empty basket, a carton of cigarettes, a bag of sweets, chewing gum, a bottle of rice wine, and a new hat. While he is busy haggling with Bajai Sita over a watch that is kotizai, I place 2 things in the basket, a sweater for Amma and a coat for the baby. It is a rich and happy day for our family, an 800-rupee day, a festive and auspicious day, and so I add 1 more thing for Amma, a costly treat that only the headman's wife can afford, a bottle of Coca-Cola, the sweet drink that people say is like having tiny fireworks in your mouth. My stepfather scowls, but he does not say anything. On any other day, he would not tolerate such defiance, especially from a mere girl. But today, I am no mere girl. A second look. As Auntie and I leave the store, I see Krishna coming down the dirt road with his flock of goats. He is whistling and coaxing a straggler to join the others by tickling its rump with a long stem of elephant grass. I pray that he will look in my direction, but as always, his eyes are fixed on the ground before him. I want to tell him where I'm going, to tell him that I will return as soon as I am able with a cash dowry for our wedding. I want to tell him to wait for me.
Eyes forward, Auntie says. No sense looking back.
I lower my head and obey. But as we reach the end of the village, I turn around 1 last time and steal 1 last look at the boy I have been watching for as long as I can remember. Moving forward. Auntie says I must walk ahead of her, even though I do not know the way.
I will be behind you, she says.
I am too shy to tell her I won't run off. Too timid to tell her how proud and nervous and excited I am to be the first person in my family to leave the mountain. I feel a tiny sting on the backs of my legs, and I realize that Auntie has thrown a handful of gravel at my heels to keep me moving forward. A new world. We have been walking all day. We have traveled through 3 villages where the people pause in their labors and gape at us, and where even the water buffalo stare at us with the solemn eyes of old men. I stare, too, at all the things I've never seen before.
a man pulling a wild boar on a rope, a herd of yak hauling sacks of salt, a mail runner ringing a cluster of bells as he nears a village, a rope footbridge strung like a spider web, a river that runs white, and a man with teeth entirely of gold. I ask Auntie how she knows the way to the city. She says that we are simply following the footsteps of all the others who have gone before us. I try to remember each hut, each village. I try to memorize each twist in the path so I can find my way home at festival time next year. But when I close my eyes, each hut, each village, each twist in the road looks the same. And when I open my eyes and look behind us, the poinsettias stir in the wind as if touched by fire. It is a new world. But there is one constant, the mighty swallow-tailed peak. It grows smaller the farther we walk, but still it is always there, waiting to guide me back. What I carry. Inside the bundle Amma packed for me are my bowl, my hairbrush, the notebook my teacher gave me for being the number one girl in school, and my bedroll. Inside my head I carry my baby goat, my baby brother, my Amma's face, our family's future. My bundle is light. My burden is heavy. Questions and answers. Auntie and I have been walking for 2 days and a half. We have passed through 7 villages, each one invisible to the other because of the mountain between them, but each one the same, with women pounding laundry on rocks at the village fountains and men sitting cross-legged in the tea shops. We go up and down hills, sometimes following a dirt path, sometimes following an empty riverbed, sometimes following no trail at all. When we stop to rest, Auntie pulls a packet of bitter leaf tobacco from her waistcloth. She stuffs a wad of it between her gum and teeth, rocks back on her heels, and chews. "Auntie," I say finally, "tell me about the city." She spits, and a stream of red beetle juice lands on the ground between us.
"You will have to see it for yourself."
"Is it true that all the roofs are covered in gold?"
"Where did you hear that?" she says.
"In school." I want Auntie to know that I am not a backward girl. I am educated. She spits again and says that I am very smart, that I will do well in the city. I have 100 questions. How long will it take for us to get there? How do I address my mistress? How can I find Gita? But I ask only one. What are these things called movies? Auntie says that in the city, people gather and pay money to see beautiful women and handsome men put on a show. The people in the show are called movie stars. "Are you a movie star, Auntie?" She smiles, and I see then what was behind the shawl she always draws to her lips, a mouth of blackened teeth. I smile back, but inside I am a tiny bit afraid of my new auntie. An inauspicious start. At the 9th village, Auntie tells me we will ride the rest of the way. My feet silently thank her while I sit by the side of the road and wait for a bullock cart to appear. She points to a metal wagon with 2 men inside and says I am to sit in the back, in the open, along with the cucumbers and chickens. I climb up, my bundle at my side, while Auntie gets in front. Suddenly the beast roars, 100 times louder than my stepfather's motorcycle, and I cry out in terror. The cart lunges forward. All at once we are moving fast over the dirt road as the huts and shops rush by in a blur. I squawk, just like the chickens, clap a hand over my mouth to try to stop myself, and cry out again as this roaring, lurching cart jounces and bounces in and out of every rut in the road, until finally I am laughing at the sheer madness of it. Soon, though, I can feel my breakfast of tea and rice water coming up my throat. I clump my teeth together, but the bitter meal surges up onto my teeth and flies out of my mouth without warning. I wipe my mouth. Soon I am smiling again. because as I bounce along back here, only the chickens know about this inauspicious start to my journey. The city. We have been bumping along a dirt road for hours when our cart is joined by another, then another, then another. Some have people sitting inside them, some have people riding on top, some have animals inside, some have animals on top. Some carts bleat like goats, some whine like mosquitoes. Some have two wheels, some have three, some have too many to count. Soon the road is all madness and noise. This must be the city. Next. As our cart shoulders its way along the road, I